the group has somewhere else to go. Do you need to go now? Okay. Well, thank you very much for stopping by. I'm sure you got all that down. So there'll be a quiz tomorrow.
They ask questions of the lawyers.
Yeah, I remember. Really she told me she went to that.
They're going to go see Marshall's tour now. Much better. Yeah. Yeah. It's a good way for them to finish up.
Do they tase somebody? That's always a good one.
No, they don't.
Their favorite to see the cameras. They can pinpoint people at Bayside. And they're like, well, that's
okay. You're getting overtime for this, I presume, Mr. Keller.
Ask Mr. Gilbert to put in for me.
Okay, I will do that. I will do that. Okay, last case today, number 21-10335, Plumbers and Pipe Fitters Local Union 630 versus GlaxoSmithKline. Okay, you're on.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Ashley Keller, once again, for Plumbers.
Right, let me... Since you've been with us for two of these already, I don't feel too bad interrupting you before you start. So let me tell you how I see this case. This is one that I sort of have an idea about. Okay? And I want you to tell me whether I'm right or wrong on any of these things. But okay, I think it's undisputed that there is a case or controversy between Plumbers and Pipe Fitters as against at least some defendants on at least some claims.
Yes.
Right, that there are no justiciability issues with regard to some of the claims that Plumber has.
My friends will say if they disagree, but I believe that's correct.
Okay, well, I think it's pretty clear. I shouldn't say undisputed, but I think it's pretty clear that there's an Article III case or controversy with some diagram of defendant, claim, plaintiff. If I'm right about that, and we have at least a case or controversy for appellate purposes, it doesn't get to standing or anything, but just a general case or controversy issue, then why doesn't the failure of Plumbers to challenge the shotgun pleading ruling really create a problem? As I see the district court's order on the complaint at issue, the CTPPCC, it said that there were two shotgun pleading issues, and then there were some standing issues, and there were some preemption issues. But the shotgun pleading issues weren't limited to the preemption and standing problems. The shotgun pleading issues that the district court at least thought existed were that each of the counts incorporated 519 of the earlier allegations, and that the complaint, in the district judge's view, didn't sufficiently differentiate factually between defendants and claims, that it made it difficult to figure out what every defendant's factual basis of liability was. And it seems to me that there's a pretty good argument that that ruling is independent of the preemption and standing rulings, and that the failure to address shotgun pleading on appeal creates a problem for you under our line of cases, including Sapupo. Now, as Judge Luck mentioned in one of the two earlier cases, I forget which one it was, I'm with him that I don't think it creates a mootness issue under our law. I know other circuits have gone the mootness route. I don't think we have, so I think it's just a merits issue. But whatever you call it, I think it creates a problem for you. So that's my two cents on how at least I see this case initially.
I think you have most of that right. Let me tell you why I don't think that the shotgun pleading issue is a problem. I agree it's not properly categorized as a question of jurisdiction or mootness, but even if you put that to one side and use different nomenclature like the merits, we obviously have to address the thrust of Your Honor's question. And Plumbers here is similarly situated to Ms. Williams in that it only wishes to pursue a misbranding theory. And I will confess that this case illustrates why not amending first, even though we don't have to, we could just appeal under Sherman, which is what Plumbers did. It creates confusion. The brands thought that they were part of this appeal, and I'll take responsibility for that. I can see why they would have thought that, even though all of the claims against brand manufacturers were dismissed without prejudice and leave to replead, which means that by appealing, we were forever forfeiting those rights. I could see how they were confused and thought they were part of this case. I could see how Your Honor would think by just appealing without amending first, we were still pursuing all of those other claims where there are shotgun pleading problems rife throughout. We are only pursuing claims that parallel the federal misbranding statute. Plumbers has abandoned all of those other claims by sheer dint of appealing, but I hope that brings into focus why what Cardi and Williams did was actually quite useful to make it clear up front that the issues were narrowed. I think that Your Honor is also correct. There can't be any dispute that Plumbers has Article III jurisdiction for itself. It's alleging classic pocketbook injury, in fact. It's saying that it paid for a drug that if you take all of the allegations in the complaint as true, that drug was worthless. It seeks redress from the parties that sold the drug to Plumbers, the generic manufacturers who sold the prescription drug to Plumbers and Plumbers' representatives. And of course, an Article III tribunal can redress that injury.
Can I explore that a little bit?
Of course.
So I agree with Judge Jordan that at least as to some claims, there is clearly standing, it appears to me, and that as a matter of article, as a matter of appellate jurisdiction, there is appellate standing. We're here appropriately, at least on the standing issue. But we still have an obligation before we reach any merits to deal with any standing issues overall. And we have said, and again, I want you to correct me if I'm wrong in any of this, we have said that we don't do standing in Gross, that it's a claim-by-claim analysis. Correct or not correct?
That is what you've said, yes.
Okay. As I understand this complaint, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, because I fully subscribe to what you said, is this thing is not a model of clarity. As I understand it, there are 9 overall claims. Let's take out the RICO, so we're talking about claims 2 through 9. Those are overarching theories, and within those theories are embedded, in most cases, 52 individual claims, one for each state that has that theory, and I think you guys only list 47 for the DUPTA claims, the defective or the Deceptive and Unfair Trade Practice Acts that are the various states have. Is that fair?
That is fair, Your Honor.
Okay. Now I've gone through this thing as best as I can, and I will admit that I could have some of this wrong, but it seems to me that at least as to some defendants, that there's no allegation that reimbursement was done as to all of those defendants. It seems to me that there are no allegations by any of the 3 plaintiffs, and I include all 3 of them because for standing purposes, we'd have to look at all of them and all those allegations, as to Ajanta, Aurobindo, Contract Pharmaceutical, Jerry Care, Mylan, Taro, Torrent, and Zydus Cadila. I didn't see any allegations of reimbursement that was paid to any of those particular defendants. And more problematic, I didn't see any allegations of reimbursement being done as to 19 states and D.C. and Puerto Rico. So if there are 50 claims for each of those subsets and 22 generic defendants alleged, it seems to me that there are no allegations at least as to 9 of those defendants, and it seems to me that there is no claims of reimbursement as to 19 of those states. So do we have standing in those for those claims?
I think this goes to the class representative standing issue.
Let me clarify. It does not. I agree with you on class representative. This goes to the individual standing of the plaintiffs themselves. If they have not alleged that they reimbursed a particular defendant, meaning there's nothing redressable for those defendants, and they have not alleged that in a particular state, not as a representative capacity, but in that state they did not reimburse anybody in that state, then how can they allege an unjust enrichment claim, for example, in West Virginia, which is one of the states, where no reimbursement ever happened in West Virginia for any plaintiff?
for any plaintiff, including an absent class member.
Well, maybe not an absent class member, but we, but for, as I understand, Prado and Mills and Fox, I'm a little familiar with.
Indeed.
You go, we look first, is there standing for the plaintiffs there? And then the question is the injury and interest similar for class standing? I'm not talking about injury and interest. I'm with you on that. I'm looking at these guys who are alleged have to have standing to be there.
I think that's a fair interpretation of your precedent. We did argue below for a more capacious rule that had some support in the Seventh Circuit, but I take your point, and to the extent that there are no allegations for those particular causes of action against those defendants or from those states, I would agree that at least persuasive dicta and maybe holdings of this court might suggest that there's no standing. The principal issue that we're taking up with respect to class representative standing is the district court's blanket rule that a class representative can't pursue causes of action on behalf of absent class members from other states. And I think that cannot be correct as a matter certainly of the case or controversy requirement of Article 3. There's all sorts of Rule 23 issues associated with that. And of course, we concede that point. We're going to have to tick through all of the Rule 23 boxes. That's a vigorous process that hasn't even begun yet. There's likely to be expert testimony. And of course, my friends on the other side are free to join that issue and say that we don't satisfy any of the Rule 23 factors. But none of that deals with this court's constitutional authority to adjudicate a dispute with a named class representative on behalf of absent class members who happen to hail from other states. And I know Your Honor's quite familiar
And this may be different than the precise question that Judge Luck has asked you, but if the named class representatives, before you get to a class certification stage, don't share the same injury as absent class members from states in which they don't operate or reimburse or pay, where's the link?
All of the class members who are absent, according to our allegations, share precisely the same injury. These are all third-party payers who paid for prescription ranitidine and now want their money back. So they're all alleging the same pocketbook injury. You know, there might be some variations in the volume.
So you think that, let me see how to even phrase this to make it intelligible. So you think that the geographic locus of the absent class members in relation to the named plaintiff is a matter that goes only to Rule 23 class certification issues and not to Article 3 standing issues.
If you'll forgive me, I'd rephrase that slightly. I don't think it's the geographic locus. I think it's differences in state law causes of action may create meaningful enough differences that the named plaintiff can't represent them. And so to the extent—
No, what I meant by the geographic, and I'll take your amendment, but the geographic locus I meant is that if you have a named class plaintiff who never had members in, let's use Georgia, never reimbursed anybody in Georgia, never paid anybody for anything in Georgia, it is still okay for Article 3 standing purposes to try to assert a claim on behalf of an absent class member whose injury was localized in Georgia.
Yes, I believe it is. Okay. That is no different than going to a different Ritz-Carlton restaurant that happens to be in the state of Florida, but it's a different restaurant than the one that Mr. Fox patronized. That's exactly the same circumstance.
I get the theory. I just want to make sure I have it right.
You do have it right.
Can I move to the merits for
yes.
a second? Because you're at that two-minute thing that we seem to, that's a good point to move. I think we're in a worse spot than we were with Mr. Williams, because at least with Mr. Williams, we knew a law to compare it to. And I take your point that maybe the district court should make that call in the first instance. But I ask the same question, which is, in my mind, I generally accept your theory that footnotes 3 and 4 and Bartlett carve out something. And we have to determine whether that something is like the 50 claims you've raised for unjust enrichment and the 50 claims you raised for the various different theories. That's a lot of work for state law, and you and the other side, both sides, have given us nothing other than generalities, Restatement K, for example. I mean, there's a lot of variation in state law on this stuff, and I just don't know where I begin to make the determination of where law is parallel such that it's not preempted.
Your Honor anticipated where I was going to go when we reached the merits, which is this case highlights way more than Ms. Williams' case why you should remand and not deal with these issues in the first instance because there's a lot of state law. But let me give you one intuitive example that hopefully shows that in at least a lot of states, Plumbers is going to be able to prevail, and that's warranty claims. There's an implied warranty of merchantability. You can't sell a product that isn't merchantable. That's pretty black letter state law. There may be variations, and again, we didn't go into detail with all 52 territories and states of the United States because we didn't have the space and the district court never considered that in the first instance. But you obviously can't sell a drug with a powerful carcinogen and mutagen inside of it and say that you're complying with your warranty of merchantability. In just about every jurisdiction, that's going to be unlawful and entitle Plumbers to a remedy. And so hopefully that's a good illustration that there is work to do on remand and there are parallel claims at issue here.
Thank you very much. Mr. Arthur.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Amit Agarwal appearing on behalf of the generic manufacturer defendants. Unless the court would prefer otherwise, I'd like to start out by addressing jurisdiction. And if I may, Judge Jordan, I'll go straight to a point that you made in an earlier colloquy with opposing counsel, and that is that sometimes jurisdiction is about technicalities and not about practical considerations. I'd like to identify for the court's consideration some of the practical concerns that we think are intertwined with the jurisdictional analysis.
And as you do that, I'd like you to try to take on the same question that I asked your colleagues on the same side in the earlier two cases, which is what, putting aside the shotgun pleading issues, to get up here jurisdictionally, what was Plumbers supposed to have done?
So there are four things that they could have done differently. And the immediate thing is that when they elected to take an immediate appeal and not to file an amended complaint, they could have appealed the district court's shotgun pleading ruling and thereby adhered to the position that they emphatically staked out in the district court.
But under our law, that's merits-based. I understand that there are circuits that go differently and talk about it in jurisdictional terms and mootness terms and all that, but our cases like Sapupo mean that that's an affirmance on the merits, not an Article III problem. So, what were they supposed to do to get up here properly is my question, I guess.
A couple of other things that they could have done, Your Honor, is first, not to file the impermissible shotgun pleading in the first place. Second,
that has nothing to do. Well, that has nothing to do with whether they're properly here.
Counsel, you agree this is a final order. There's no question that this is a final order.
That's right. The decision
to. So we're not in the same situation that we are with Cardi and Williams, right?
Yeah, that's right. So there is.
So what other problems? I guess a better way of asking it, and I shouldn't have asked it the same way. What other issues besides the shotgun pleading problem affect our ability to hear their Plumbers' appeal on the merits? Or is there nothing else besides that?
So the problem is that because of the shotgun pleading, the district court judge, as it emphasized at docket entry 2515, and I'll give you some cites, found it difficult to address the precise issues that plaintiffs now seek to raise on appeal. And we have two issues. We have Article III standing, and the district court says on pages 13 and 14 and also on 23 and 24 of its shotgun pleading order that it's struggling to assess Article III standing precisely because there is this impermissible shotgun pleading. And then on page 43, Your Honor, the district court talks about the misbranding issue that is, of course, a big subject in this appeal. And the district court says, I don't know what to make of that theory because of the way that the complaint has been pled, and I'm going to give you some specific guidance on what you can do to clear that up for me so that I can clearly assess the misbranding issue that, again, plaintiff now seeks to raise on appeal. So our point is that there are practical considerations that are intertwined with the jurisdictional analysis. I'd like to just make one additional observation on that point, and that is we're now in a situation where every single sentence, every paragraph, every count of this complaint has been dismissed. And plaintiff did not appeal that ruling. And yet the court is being asked to assess the validity of that same complaint. And how do you do that? The only way you can do that is by looking at the factual allegations in the operative complaint and asking, do those factual allegations, for example, suffice to establish Article III standing?
So I think as a threshold, even though I agree with you and I feel for the district court that it's in the spot that it was in, and I think this raises some interesting issues about why it's important to get on the shotgun pleading issue first, to clean up the complaint, to get sort of the best complaint so we can know exactly what those allegations are that go to standing and the merits. But we still have, we have an obligation independently to look at it. So that's what I'm struggling with a little bit. Do you agree, it seemed to be that your opposing counsel conceded that at least with regard to some states, allegations with regard to some states or claims in some states, and at least as to some defendants, that the complaint was deficient on injury in fact and redressability as to the named plaintiffs. So not class standing, but on plaintiff standing itself. Do you agree with that?
Yes, if I understood Your Honor's question correctly, I do agree. The problem is that under the law of this circuit, a named plaintiff has to have standing to bring every claim in the case. And here we just don't have that situation.
But we have at least some. I mean, you would agree that there at least as to, for instance, Plummer says that it did reimbursement in, let's take Alabama, for example, mm-hmm. in Alabama, and they've alleged that they've reimbursed as to these defendants. They at least have claims, an Alabama unjust enrichment claim as to those defendants, correct?
Sure. And what they don't have standing to do is to say that because a named plaintiff purchased ranitidine in Florida, that named plaintiff has standing to bring a claim that another defendant sold a different product or ranitidine containing product in Alaska in violation of Alaska law.
So let's explore that a little bit, because it seems to me that our inquiry is broader than just a legal inquiry. That might not be the best way to describe it, but it's a little broader than just comparing causes of action or elements. It looks at whether it's the same injury and same interest. It seems to me a really low threshold. So if an unnamed plaintiff in Alaska did reimbursement, meaning they paid for something that they say was defective and they should be reimbursed for their money for that, isn't that an injury that's very similar, not identical, but similar to the injury in Florida that we described? And the interest in getting the money back is similar?
It may be very similar, and it may be that Your Honor is right that the jurisdictional analysis, or it may be that the injuries are very similar. It may be that the elements of each cause of action are very similar. It may even be that every single aspect of every conceivable defense to that cause of action is similar. But how do we know that at the outset of the litigation?
Well, we can compare injury, can't we? I mean, theoretically, it wouldn't be me, it'd be some law clerk, would go in and look at the elements of unjust enrichment in 50 different states. But that's not really the question we have. The question we have is, were you injured in the same way? And the injury is not, is this cause of action, do you have this cause of action or not? That's a merits determination. It is, the injury alleged is, I paid for something that was defective that I didn't have to pay for, whether it's a breach of warranty or an unjust enrichment theory or whatever.
So I have a legal answer to Your Honor's question and a practical answer, and I'll start with the legal answer. Under the doctrine that's been enunciated by the Supreme Court, what has to be shown is an injury in fact defined as a concrete and particularized invasion of a legally protected interest. And so there's a factual component to that. And
Can I jump in on the legal side there? Because that's the, you quoted exactly what the test is from Lujan and from any number of cases on injury in fact. But that's not what we're dealing with here. And it seems to me that we don't have the same requirements. Once they've established they have an injury, and once the named plaintiff has established an injury in fact, the second question about class standing, and again, we're assuming because the law in our circuit seems to assume that it is an Article III inquiry and not a Rule 23 inquiry, but that under the Article III inquiry, the question then is really simple, is that injury in fact similar in kind to the injury in fact of another? Not if it is a concrete and particularized, but is it a similar sort of injury, right?
Well, our position is that if you have an invasion of a legally protected right under one law, that that is a different injury for purposes of Article III standing. And I'd like to go on to the practical point, Your Honor, if I may.
Even if the underlying law is exactly the same?
So that is our position. Now, the First Circuit has staked out that intermediate position where if the parties have agreed that the law is identical in every conceivable respect, then maybe that suffices to get you past Article III standing. But that certainly is not the case.
But in determining, this is the part that always causes me problems with standing jurisprudence, which is you have to accept on the merits that the plaintiff is going to win and has a valid cause of action. You don't question that in assessing standing. The Supreme Court has told us that. And so what do you do when a plaintiff alleges that the answer to something is X on the merits of its claim? Aren't you required to accept that as truth, as truthful, at least in assessing whether or not at this stage of the proceedings, a claim has been pled to provide Article III standing?
I think we think that part of the problem with plaintiff's position is that it would effectively require the district court to adjudicate the merits of a lot of these issues at the threshold just in order to determine whether there's Article III standing. And that's particularly the case insofar as plaintiff's position is predicated on the idea that as long as all these causes of action are materially identical, then there's not an Article III standing problem. So the practical point that I wanted to make, Your Honor, is that we have all of us had the experience of working for months, maybe even for years, on trying to figure out what is one element of one cause of action. What does that mean? The reason we have a Supreme Court is because courts of appeals can and do disagree about the meaning of the exact same textual provision. But plaintiff's position in this litigation is predicated on the idea that you can have seven different state law counts, multiply it by 50 jurisdictions, and they can just tell the district court, just assert at the outset of the litigation, that every single element of that tort, every single aspect of every conceivable defense is going to be materially indistinguishable. And we think, just as a practical matter, that can't be right. I would also refer, Your Honor, respectfully to the Daimler-Chrysler case, where the Supreme Court said, look, even if you have different legal claims arising out of the exact same transaction or occurrence, you still have to show Article III standing as to each claim. We would argue that our position follows a fortiori from that precedent, because here you have different legal claims arising out of different transactions and occurrences. I see that my time is running out a little bit. I'm happy to move on to the merits unless the court has...
Whatever you'd
were there,
like.
One last question. Yes. Were there not allegations, at least as to some claims, that they were similar in kind state by state?
There are bare assertions, Your Honor, but plaintiff's counsel candidly conceded in the district court that they haven't done these 50 state surveys with respect to every claim that they're bringing.
But that's a Rule 11 problem, because not a standing problem, because... I mean, the Supreme Court has told us at least twice expressly that you are not supposed to question the merits of a plaintiff's theory in deciding Article III standing. We've said it expressly in Culverhouse. So if they tell you that the elements are identical or similar, aren't you supposed to take that at face value, at least for standing purposes at the 12B6 stage?
I don't think you need to do that, especially if we're right at the threshold that an alleged violation of a different law enacted by a different sovereign gives rise to a different invasion of a legally protected interest for purposes of Article III standing analysis.
And that's a merits question, I think. Is it not?
I apologize. It took me a while to get there. Paragraphs 575 and 580, which are related to counts 2 and 3, for example, those are the express and implied warranty ones. The plaintiffs allege, quote, all 50 states and D.C. and Puerto Rico have the same law of express and implied warranties, the Uniform Commercial Code.
As to some of the claims?
As to some of those claims, right. So at least as to those, would you agree that the interest and the injury would be similar?
No,
enough?
We would not agree. We think they are different legally protected interests, and we haven't stipulated in this case that every single element and every single conceivable common law defense that might apply in those different jurisdictions is materially indistinguishable.
So if you, let me get this right. So if you have, let's make it an easy case. So Plumbers has paid out or reimbursed expenses for this medication in Florida and in Georgia, okay? So it has, in one sense of the word, financial harm, right? Which every court has said is a tangible, particularized, concrete injury, right?
Yes.
Okay. But the laws of Florida and Georgia are slightly different in terms of what they require for the cause of action. You would say that those are different injuries for Article III standing? You would analyze the injury in fact element as different?
For laws enacted by different jurisdictions, yes. We would say that they are invasions of different legally protected interests for purposes of the injury prong of Article III standing analysis.
And you don't think that's a merits question?
I don't.
What's your best authority for that proposition?
Well, I think the Daimler-Chrysler case is good authority for that proposition.
You agree that just about every circuit that has addressed some form of this has disagreed, right?
So we would not agree with that, Your Honor. The Seventh Circuit case that plaintiff's counsel relies on doesn't support their position in our view at all because the named...
Those were single jurisdiction cases.
That's right, because the named plaintiff and the absent class members were all raising claims under the exact same state law, and that's the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act. The Second Circuit and the Fourth Circuit have taken a different approach. We think that the analysis in those cases is unpersuasive, in part because it seems to proceed on a false assumption. I see my time has run out. May I continue?
Of course.
Yeah, those courts seem to us to be proceeding on a false assumption, and that is because you have this really big Rule 23 class certification problem, therefore you must not have an Article 3 standing problem. And that seems to us to be analytically wrong. This type of situation can raise serious concerns under both Article 3 and about the propriety of class certification under Rule 23, in addition to which, of course, we have authority from the Supreme Court and from this court holding that you got to do the Article 3 standing analysis first, and it just can't be the case that a district court is required to assume that it has Article 3 standing until the propriety of class certification is determined at a later stage in the proceeding, and then, if and only if, the district court finds that Rule 23 certification is proper, then, okay, everyone can be satisfied that Article 3 standing exists, but presumably could not be satisfied that Article 3 standing exists if the class certification analysis came out differently. So that just analytically seems wrong to us. I am over my time. I'm happy to address the merits if Your Honors would like.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Agarwal.
If I may, I would like to address the concern that Judge Luck raised about the footnotes in Bartlett, but...
Can you have a minute or two on that?
Sure, of course.
Thank you.
Yeah, so Judge Luck, I think you asked a really important question about footnotes 3 and 4 in Bartlett, and they have to mean something. We think those footnotes are acknowledging that there are certain facts that the Supreme Court has not been squarely presented with, and not that the court is carving out any kind of exception to the bright line preemption rules that it articulated in Mensing and in Bartlett.
It seems to be more than a fact issue, though. I mean, the Supreme Court seems to suggest that if state law had such a claim or similar duties, that might present a different case. I mean, that seems to be what it is. It isn't just saying with different facts, we would consider this differently. I've seen footnotes like that, but it seems to talk about a legal issue of the kind of duties or parallel, it seems to assume the possible existence of a parallel claim. Now, I don't know if that thing ever exists. It may not, but.
Yeah, so on the existence of the parallel misbranding claim, a couple of points. One is that to the extent that that claim is based on a textually plausible interpretation of an identifiable federal statute, that parallel misbranding argument has been repeatedly presented to the Supreme Court and repeatedly rejected by the court, not once, not twice, but 3 times, 2 times in Mensing and once in Bartlett. And the argument there was, look, it's illegal to sell a misbranded drug in interstate commerce, and therefore, these federal and state law duties are parallel for purposes of implied preemption analysis. And that argument was made, for example, on page 45 of respondents' brief in Bartlett. It was made in Mensing by the Solicitor General and by the respondent. It was accepted by the Eighth Circuit, and the Supreme Court squarely rejected it. So there's no way to interpret Mensing and Bartlett that is compatible with that textually, somewhat arguably textually plausible interpretation of, in particular, 21 U.S.C. 331 and 352. Then the question becomes, well, can there be this different kind of carve-out, this situation where, based on that novel and creative theory that was propounded by the Solicitor General's office in its amicus brief to the court in Bartlett, maybe there's this other exception to bright-line preemption that might exist. And the problem with that argument is that it's at war with the plain language of the statute insofar as it tries to say that there is a federal law duty for purposes of implied preemption analysis not to sell a drug that has been expressly and unambiguously determined by the FDA at the relevant time to be safe and effective for use. And we know that because the Supreme Court in Mensing says your pertinent federal law duty, if you're a generic drug company subject to the duty of sameness, is to make sure that your drug is the same as the brand name listed drug, not a duty to avoid selling a misbranded drug. So in order to say that you would have this, this footnote for Bartlett exception, the court would have to read the language of section 352 and 331 to say that there's a federal law duty that allows you to sell misbranded drugs except when all these conditions are present, except when the drug is just so dangerous that there's nothing that you could ever do to make it safe, even if you had the most precise and careful label imaginable. And on top of that, that the state law cause of action would have to say that the misbranding determination is based on new and scientifically significant information that was not previously available to the FDA. So this is inventing kind of a new cause of action that may be desirable as a matter of social policy, but it can't be found anywhere in the plain language of the statute. And on top of that, it would create this kind of exception that would effectively eviscerate the federal statutory regime that's applicable to generic drugs. And the Supreme Court has told us about the policies that Congress incorporated into the FDCA, and the policy goal is to make sure that not only are these drugs safe because they're bioequivalent to the brand name drugs, but also that those, we're gonna make sure that because of the special and different regulatory regime that's applicable to generic drug makers, that this generic, that we'll have more generic drugs be made available to more consumers more quickly and more cheaply. And if generic drug makers have to go through all the same investigations that brand name drug makers have to go through, as the Supreme Court has explained in cases like Mensing and Bartlett, that regulatory framework goes out the window, and you're not going to have those policies that Congress expressly incorporated into the FDCA. I appreciate the court allowing me to go over my time.
That costs extra. All right, thank you, Mr. Agarwal.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Keller, you're going to wrap up the day for us.
Yes, indeed. I'm going to start where you did, Judge Jordan, with shotgun pleading, because I want to say something very clearly. There's a reason we didn't appeal the shotgun pleading order. It's because we agree with it. And I'm not going to be one of those appellant counsels who said, oh, I'm just counsel on appeal. I had nothing to do with it below. I did have something to do with the complaint below, so I'll take responsibility for some of the sins of shotgun pleading. But we had no opportunity to cure those sins because the district court expressly instructed us to remove all allegations with the one theory that we want to pursue. And so that's putting us in this terrible catch-22. I can't wait to atone for the sins of shotgun pleading on remand. We will do it, and we get one shot under Wyland at least to do it. And if we don't, and the district court says we've still failed in that task, that can support a dismissal with prejudice without leave to replead, and then we'd be up here on an abuse of discretion standard that would be much harder. But we can't be forced to appeal an order that we agree with just to avoid a mootness problem, or as Your Honor put it, it's not technically mootness, but an alternative ground to affirm. We would love to fix our complaint We agree that we could have done some work initially to make it better, but we get more than one shot at it under this court's precedent. So we shouldn't be put in this impossible position. I've conceded to Judge Luck already. There's no squarely on point precedent in this circuit talking about so-called futile amendments, but this is the sort of factual context where we shouldn't be penalized. I think a better rule, which was maybe implicit in some of your questions, would be if there is a shotgun pleading order problem, that's where the district court should stop. It shouldn't also say, even though it's tough for me, I'm going to address all these other issues like preemption and Article III standing and then put you in a trick box, to use some language.
Wouldn't it have been much easier for us if there were 50 claims brought for each of the subclaims, assuming you wanted to proceed on all of them, and I don't know the answer to that, but there were 50 unjust enrichment claims and 50 breach of implied warranty claims, laying out the standing an injury for each one of those things.
Yes.
And that would have made our job a lot easier. To me, that's the argument for why it should have been done, even if the district court was going to automatically kick anything that had a misbranding, And then you could have dismissed, in the same way that you did with the Cardi and Williams one, anything else that you didn't want to proceed on.
But it's not automatically kick, Your Honor. We were told don't do it. Strip these out of your complaint. I don't want to see these in your amended complaint. That's different than, you know, there's a good chance I'm going to just stand on my preemption order and you're going to be out of luck again. We were expressly told not to. So we shouldn't be required to thumb our nose at the district court's order, even when we agree with the shotgun pleading portion of the decision. So I recognize we could have done more in our initial complaint, and that's on us. But we're supposed to be given a chance to cure. Given the merits issues that the district court reached, we can't cure on the one theory that we want to pursue. Let me quickly turn to the merits and my friend's statement with respect to Mensing. Mensing never considered this twice. The parallel misbranding, stop selling rationale never came up in the actual party's brief. It did come up in the Solicitor General's brief, and the district court never considered a stop selling.
And it was in the rehearing motion.
Yeah, in a motion for reconsideration after the Supreme Court has already issued an opinion, those have gone zero for infinity in actually getting granted. So the notion that the issue was considered by the Supreme Court because of that, I think, stretches the factual record a little bit. The actual duty that the Supreme Court was considering that was the only thing tethered to misbranding was stated very clearly in Justice Thomas's opinion. Federal law said maybe it was willing to presume that you have to come to the FDA as a generic and ask permission to change the label. State law said no permission, you just have to change the label. With that presumption, there was conflict between state and federal law. The stop selling rationale never came up, and this idea that it's not clear from the statute to stop selling, it is crystal clear. 21 U.S.C. Section 331 G, C, and A says that everyone in the stream of commerce, retailers, distributors, and manufacturers, cannot introduce into commerce a misbranded drug. There's no ambiguity in the text. And this idea as well that the FDA has already considered the safety profile of the drug, so it can't possibly be subject to a misbranding rationale, that's belied by the footnote in Bartlett, which said new science can come to light that could make it so that a drug becomes misbranded. And it's also belied by the FDA's own regulations, 21 CFR 314.170. The definition of misbranding applies to all drugs, including those that are already on the market and subject to approval.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much.